Tonight on Dateline.
Brittany went down to Myrtle Beach. She told her mother that she was at a friend's house.
This nonstop kids cruising the boulevard.
She's entering the Blue Water Resort. She is then seen leaving 15 minutes later.
He left the motel not long after she did. They were certainly our prime suspects at this point. She was texting with her boyfriend. It stopped suddenly.
It's like the sidewalk opened up and she was gone. Somebody knows something somewhere.
Didn't you get a call from Brittany's phone at one point?
Her phone had made a beeline from Myrtle Beach down to this really rural area 50 miles south.
Part of the section is called Hell Hole.
Oh, we all had these fantasies about snatching girls off the street.
Was she scared? Was she screaming? You just don't want your best friend to ever feel that way.
We went through years with nothing.
But you can't give up, because if you give up, then you're giving up on her, and she would never have given up on anybody.
She disappeared on spring break on a street packed with people. Watch as police try to solve the puzzle. I'm Lester Holt, and this is Dateline. Here's Keith Morrison with The Last Walk.
The night was lit like a festival, like a celebration she was no part of. As the girl, disappointed and alone, hurried along the crowded boulevard. Was she upset? She must have been. Embarrassed, perhaps.
If you had to count up, how many times over these past years do you think about that night, that last walk, that street she was walking down?
You can't even put a number on it. Thought about it for 13 years.
It was Saturday night, the end of spring break, 2009. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. The girl made her way through the party crowd milling along South Ocean Boulevard. She was younger than most of them, and tiny, barely 5 feet tall. Her name was Brittany Drexel. What happened on that boulevard to her has haunted a legion. Family, friends, investigators who tried and sometimes failed to see the truth. Here's her dad, Chad Drexel.
When you look back over the last 13 years, what's it done to you?
Oh, goodness. What hasn't it done? Every emotion you can think of, probably.
Thing was, Brittany was not supposed to be in Myrtle Beach that spring break weekend. As far as her parents knew, she was with trusted friends at a beach on Lake Ontario, just a few miles from home in Rochester, New York. Both parents had already nixed the Myrtle Beach idea. She was too young, they said. Besides, she barely knew the kids who were driving down. Tara Friedman, her best friend, wasn't even going.
How did Myrtle Beach come up in the first place?
So the girls that Brittany went to Myrtle Beach with had planned the trip with their significant others. So it was two couples. I don't know if, you know, Brittany was kind of like, oh, I want to go too, that sounds fun, or if they invited Brittany.
She was 17 though, right?
Yeah, Brittany was 17 at the time, and, you know, these girls were older. She asked her mother if she could go to Myrtle Beach, and, you know, her mother said no. When she asked her father said, you know, absolutely not.
She said, well, why can't I go down with my friends down to Myrtle Beach? Well, Brittany, your grades aren't great in school, and I just brought you last week late to school three times. So no, my answer is no. I agree with your mom.
The parents had put up a united front, but they were not themselves united. They had separated the year before. And ever since the breakup, Brittany had been reaching for some independence. So she spun a little tale about meeting friends at Lake Ontario, and she set her sights on the Carolina coast.
Was she a kind of a person who just, you know, she wanted to do something, she was going to do it? Was that
always the way she was? Yeah, Brittany was very, very headstrong. She goes, you know, it's my spring break. I'm going to go. I'm going to enjoy my time.
She pulled into Myrtle Beach on a Thursday morning with that group of not quite friends.
I think she texted me and was like, oh, I made it. And I was like, all right, have fun, you know, get a tan for me.
Myrtle Beach is a carnival town, jam-packed with things to do and stuff to eat. And there's always the beach, of course. So Brittany loved it, at first. Her constant stream of texts to boyfriend John Greco a kind of running narrative. But the texts soon revealed an adventure turning sour. She was feeling excluded by those older kids. 3 days that way. And then it was Saturday, April 25th.
She wasn't having fun anymore, and she felt, you know, isolated from the group that she went down there with.
Mind you, that Saturday afternoon, Brittany ran into some boys from back home, and that seemed to help. Peter Brozowitz, a 20-year-old from Rochester, was also on vacation with his friends. So that night, Brittany left her hotel, the Bar Harbor, and walked along the boulevard to Peter's hotel, the Blue Water Resort, about a mile away. But once she got there, complications.
One of the girls that she had gone down there with asked for her shorts back that Brittany had borrowed, and Britt was like, oh, I have to go walk back now to my hotel and give her back these shorts. And Brittany left that hotel and was headed back to where she was staying at the Bar Harbor.
But that would be a very public place to walk, wouldn't it?
Very public place.
Lots of people around.
Middle of spring break.
Yeah.
Tons of people. Families. Kids. Teenagers.
Where she would have been seen, walking the mile back to her hotel. Her texts with boyfriend John revealed she was annoyed, even angry. John wrote, please, just try to enjoy yourself. She replied, no, I'm staying in, packing, going to sleep, probably. John texted back, why? There was no answer. A half hour went by, an hour, still no reply. Back in Rochester, Tara's phone rang. It was John.
And he was very, very panicky. I was trying to calm him down. I was like, listen, John, I was like, you know, it's Britt. I mean, did you make her mad? Is she ignoring you? And he's like, no, I don't think so. Like, we were having a fine conversation, and now she's not answering my calls, nothing. So I got off the phone with John. I called her, phone rang, went to voicemail. Voicemail was like, hey, Britt, give me a call. John's worried. I just thought maybe she lost her phone.
Well, you don't want to let your mind go there, right?
Well, that,
you know,
yeah, exactly.
That dark place, you're going to keep it away as long as you can.
Yes, yes. You're going to absolutely not try to go and think the worst. You're not going to go to those dark places.
And why would she? Adventurous, funny Brittany would surely turn up. In fact, they were about to get a glimpse of her.
Brittany's worried family and friends head to Myrtle Beach to solve the mystery. When we come back.
Didn't pack a bag, didn't pack a toothbrush. I had like a hoodie and sweatpants on, and I was like, let's go get Britt.
And soon, police are searching too.
The longer that we went without hearing that Brittany was okay, the more concerned that we became.
It was uncommonly warm that Saturday night in Rochester, New York. Good day to be at a Lake Ontario beach, where Brittany Drexel had told her parents she would be that weekend. And then Chad got a phone call.
I didn't find out until that Saturday night that Brittany was in another state, and now she's missing from that state. And I found that out from Dawn, Brittany's mom.
Who, in turn, found out from the boyfriend. Now, amid rising anxiety, the family devised a plan. Chad would stay home with Brittany's little sister and brother, while her friends, including John and Tara, and her mom and grandparents, made the 14-hour drive to Myrtle Beach to find her.
Didn't pack a bag, didn't pack a toothbrush. I had like a hoodie and sweatpants on, and I was like, let's go get Britt.
And you decided she was going to be okay, and you'll just pick her up and bring her home.
Yeah, that's it.
First stop was the Myrtle Beach Police Department, where officers were already gathering information. But
the police were, in those very beginning hours and that first day, were still convinced that, you know, maybe she is extending her vacation.
And they would have known that she had gone away without permission anyway, so, you know, maybe she did decide to do a little bit more without permission.
Yes.
Tara, John, and the others set out on their own.
Where do you go? What did you do when you got there to find her?
We started on the boulevard. I think John brought a photo of her from home, and we had pictures like on our cell phones, our little flip phones. We went from restaurant to convenience store to a beach store, every single business, any person we could find walking.
Young, attractive girl alone? Somebody must have seen her, but no one had. Tara tried to tamp down the fear, but the mind plays tricks.
Your desperation is rising.
Desperation. And the sun started setting, and the boys were like, we're not going. We're going to keep looking for her.
Back in Rochester, Chad, unable to search, wrestled with guilt.
If I would have been a little, and I feel guilty, if I would have called Brittany. Well, what's that in the back? Don't, that doesn't sound like where we live in Charlotte Beach. That does not, where are you, Brittany?
He's a protective dad, he said, for all three of his children. But Brittany was special. He was her father by choice.
Tell me how she came into your life.
Brittany came in my life when I was in the service, and I was home on vacation. And through my sister, I met Brittany's mom, and that's when I met Brittany.
And when he married her mother, he formally adopted Brittany with the consent of her biological father.
I have a funny story, if you don't mind me.
Please.
So the adoption was really, it was really cute. I had to wear my dress whites. Brittany went with me every morning because she was still the first year before her kindergarten. So she had one last year where she still had preschool. So I picked her up and we went to the local judge there in Virginia Beach. And when I sat down, Brittany walked around and jumped right on top of my lap. And the naval judge looked at me and says, I don't even have any questions. Signed right off, and that was it.
This beautiful little girl, full of fire. Fastest one on the soccer field.
Tara was 15 when they met, a year older than Brittany. And they just clicked, playing with hairstyles, hair colors, having fun.
You know, we do all the girly things. And then we would also do, you know, a little bit of the tomboy stuff as well. We'd go dirt biking, fishing.
Close, as if they could read each other's minds. And now, in Myrtle Beach, the sun was gone, the night was dark, and Tara just knew.
She's not spending a vacation. She didn't leave. She didn't run away. Something happened to her.
So tell me, based on your experiences with Brittany, why you were so sure that she would never kind of just run away.
Brittany cared immensely about her little brother and her little sister, and she would never left them willingly.
Myrtle Beach Police Detective Tracy Chinaka.
The longer that we went without hearing that Brittany was okay, the more concerned that we became.
Detective Chinaka talked to those older girls with whom Brittany had traveled to Myrtle Beach. It was not uplifting.
When I spoke with the girls that Brittany had come down here with, they let us know that they weren't getting along that well.
The crew she went down with was not the best because she had tiffs with them. And they were teasing her and picking on her. She was the youngest.
So, were they mean girls? Maybe. But involved in Brittany's disappearance? No. The girls said Brittany left their hotel that night and they never saw her again. And then police found evidence that Brittany was indeed alone after she left her hotel and headed to where the boys from Rochester were staying.
A camera captures her walking southbound towards the Blue Water Resort, and that's at 8:15 p.m. on the night she went missing.
A ghostly image, hard to make out, but here she was. This was Brittany walking along South Ocean Boulevard. Her next stop was the Boys Hotel. And now police wanted to know what happened there.
Coming up, this was suspicious.
Her phone had made a beeline from, you know, Central Myrtle Beach down to this really rural area 50 miles south.
There's no way that Brittany went to this area in the middle of the woods by herself.
When Dateline continues.
Brittany Pretty soon, Myrtle Beach was buzzing with talk about the missing girl from New York.
It absolutely captured the attention of the community very quickly.
Including a local TV reporter named Graham Moore, who heard about Brittany's sightings all over town.
At a gas station, someone thought that they saw her. Another one at a supermarket where the checkout guy was convinced that it was Brittany who came through the line.
There was like over 200 tips that they'd seen her at this convenience store.
What did that do to you?
You know,
to hear that.
Now we're hopeful. We're like, okay, so she's here. She's here. She's just avoiding us for whatever reason.
But at the other end of every tip was crushing disappointment.
A young guy came in and said he was her boyfriend with another friend and said they were looking for her and maybe if we had seen her. The owner and I looked at the picture and neither one of us recognized her.
With every dead end, anxiety grew. Tara called her mother, Renee, back in Rochester.
Frantic. Tara was absolutely frantic.
And I said, you need to get down here because not enough is happening. And because of my mom's work history, I knew that she could come down and help.
What do you mean, because of your mom's work history? Tell me about that.
My mom used to be a private investigator.
I did a lot of criminal work. It was murder, rape, arson.
Renee drove down from Rochester the next day and found Tara and John.
I said, go door to door to the hotels. Try to find out if who's been down there, if you meet any kids or anything that had any videos or any photography from that area.
Detective Chinaka was thinking the same way. Check the hotels. And what do you know? She found crystal clear video from the Blue Water Resort catching Brittany as she arrived to visit the boys from Rochester.
She's entering the Blue Water Resort at 8:33 p.m.
Did something happen to her then? No. 15 minutes later, she was clearly fine.
She is then seen leaving the Blue Water Resort at exactly 15 minutes later at 8:48 p.m.
Brittany would have been walking north then, back to her hotel, texting constantly, as always, with her boyfriend. And then...
all of her phone calls and text messages outgoing stopped suddenly at 8:58 p.m.
8:58 p.m. Something happened.
It's like that the sidewalk opened up and she was gone. There was nothing. There was nothing.
Until 2 days later, when everything changed. Cell tower data came in. Now they could track her phone, show where it went. It wasn't good.
Her phone had made a beeline from, you know, central Myrtle Beach down to this really rural area 50 miles south of Myrtle Beach. And I think that is what set off all of the alarm bells.
Why? Because after that last text with her boyfriend, Brittany's phone suddenly moved south at the speed of a car. By 9:27, when she should have been back at her hotel, her phone was 8 miles down the coast. And then at 11:57, 3 hours after her last text, her phone pinged for the last time, more than 50 miles south of Myrtle Beach. And then it went dead.
We became very alarmed, and we knew something was wrong.
When Brittany's father learned she had been traced to a spot far from Myrtle Beach, he wondered, like everyone else, how did she end up in a vehicle? A stranger abduction seemed so unlikely.
She was on the main drag there. So if she did anything, flap her arms, throw her phone, kick her feet, leave a flip-flop and they took her, whatever, something.
Somebody would have seen something.
Yeah. So that's where I thought, she had to have been known someone. Maybe she befriended someone that no one knows about yet.
And that heaped suspicion on Peter Brozowicz and his friends from Rochester. Brittany would certainly have gotten in a car with them. Myrtle Beach Police Lieutenant Chuck Kapp, now retired, was helping run the investigation and taking a hard look at the Rochester boys.
Well, everything looked suspicious toward them, and apparently they left the motel not long after she did, and suddenly Brittany's missing. And then we later find out that they returned, checked out of the motel, left some of their belongings, and had a confrontation with the front desk clerk.
Not a good look. Not a good look at all.
They were certainly our prime suspects at this point.
So naturally, we want to speak to Peter and the other young men staying there. We want to know, what did Brittany say when she was there? Did y'all go anywhere together?
And why did they go home so quickly? Police in Rochester asked them. And their answers? They checked out. They did leave their hotel after Brittany did, but they and their phones traveled in the opposite direction from Brittany's phone.
Once we pinged their phones, it matched their story that they had actually gone out toward coastal Carolina to a party, and there were people at the party that had seen them. So while their phone was going toward coastal Carolina, Brittany's phone, and we assumed Brittany was with her phone, was going south toward Georgetown.
Now, with a new urgency, police moved their ever-expanding search operations south to a wooded, swampy area in Georgetown County, where Brittany's phone had last pinged. Her friends came too.
Thinking, you know, there's no way that Brittany went to this area in the middle of the woods by herself.
Her boyfriend John spoke with reporters by the river.
You feel then she could have been abducted, perhaps?
Yes.
And then John echoed what so many others were saying.
She wouldn't have gotten in the car with just anybody. It would have had to have been someone who gave a trusting vibe.
But who could have gained her trust seconds after she texted John? And why did her phone come down here to this scary place so far from Myrtle Beach?
Coming up.
You start seeing the officers get on the horses with sharpshooters, big guns. And
Lord.
What do you need the guns for?
The two main things that you're worried about is the gators and the hogs.
The stories they tell, these cell phone towers. This one looks down on a vast expanse of woods and wetlands in Georgetown County, near the Santee River, about 50 miles south of Myrtle Beach. And it's here that Brittany's phone last pinged. It's also here that police were facing a massive needle-in-a-haystack search.
Whenever you're faced with doing a search of this magnitude, there's no way law enforcement could virtually do it on its own.
And so, with open arms, they welcomed this army of volunteers, organized volunteers. Their leader is Monica Kaysen, founder of the Q Center for Missing Persons out of Wilmington, North Carolina.
Eye in the sky almost all the time.
Monica met us at Pole Yard Landing, a boat launch on the banks of the Santee River. This was the very spot, near as anybody could figure, where Brittany's phone pinged before going silent.
How big is this area that you're looking at?
Thousands of acres, thousands and thousands. It goes here, miles and miles back.
Could be anywhere.
Could be anywhere.
How many people did you have looking?
Probably within the first week, I was running about 700 to 800 people through on a continuous basis.
How do you get that many people?
I put a call out.
Speed was of the essence. Police knew that if Brittany was out there and somehow alive, she wouldn't last very long.
I mean, you definitely felt the urgency, like, from everyone. Like, we got to get in there. We got to, if she's out here, she's in danger.
Brittany's friends wanted to join the search.
John and Tara, they would have done anything we would have asked them. I had to explain to them that this would not be a friendly area for kids and untrained people because it's very, very harsh.
Tara watched with alarm as the searchers gathered.
Many, many canines. And then the horses start showing up, the ATVs. And then you start seeing the officers get on the horses with sharpshooters, big guns. And
Lord.
What do you need the guns for? I'm like, what are you gonna encounter out there in these woods?
I had sharpshooters with me, different shooters on all the dog teams because I wasn't about to lose a dog. So
to
bunch
what?
Of,
why would you lose a dog?
Gators, hogs.
They're all around here.
They're bad. They're bad. And that's the two main things that you're worried about is the gators and the hogs. And the hogs are mad, and they'll come charging you and stuff.
Who knew? We're talking tens of thousands of invasive feral hogs here in South Carolina.
But if they get a hold of your dog, there's nothing you can do. You know, it's going to be that quick.
You have to wonder what must have happened to this young woman and what sort of situation is she in.
Yeah.
With those kind of, that kind of wildlife around.
I think that was part of, the main part of the urgency is like, you know, we need to find her and we need to, you know, make sure she's okay. And if she's not, we need to find her before the animals pretty much do away with her.
Do away with her?
Yes.
Up above, police drones pointed their cameras at the ground.
You could walk by her clothing, but from above you can spot a lot more. So they were able to locate colors that just didn't belong.
And as the drones buzzed overhead, bloodthirsty flies made a feast of the humans down below.
Oh, I remember them walking out of an area one day, bloody. Lieutenant Cap was bloody. Blood dripping down his face, blood on his shirt. From those flies that were vicious, biting so bad. Monica was always scraped up and bloody.
But it was something they wanted to do, according to Lieutenant Cap, because this lost child had become everyone's child.
When you do an investigation, you get to know the family. And you see the devastation, what they're going through. And you try to relate it to your family. And imagine, what if this was my child? And it takes a toll.
The search went on for weeks with no sign of Brittany. Eventually, Tara had to go home.
Leaving Myrtle Beach without Brittany was very difficult. But it wasn't until I was home and her little brother and her little sister came to my house, and her little brother, Camden, had looked at me and he goes, "Why didn't you bring Britt home?" And, you know, what do you say to a five-year-old who's asking you where his sister is? And why didn't you bring her home, or why couldn't you find her? And I just looked into his eyes and I was like, "I am so sorry. I'm so sorry I couldn't find her."
Coming up, was this a possible break?
They were looking pretty hard at a group of guys very near the location where Brittany's cell phone last pinged.
And Brittany's father gets a call from Brittany's phone.
That just happened one night. I'm like, what? And everyone's like, hurry up and answer it.
When Dateline continues.
As volunteers slog through the swamps of South Carolina's low country, the story of Brittany Drexel and her mysterious disappearance went viral.
Searchers went on horseback with about
investigators pinged Brittany's phone twice after she went missing.
Day five for this search party, following up after a cell phone tower in the area picked up signals from Drexel's cell
phone. How could it not? A beautiful young girl vanishes on spring break 800 miles from home. Her parents were hoping an appearance on the Dr. Phil show would shake out some clues. Peter Brozowitz, that boy from Rochester, appeared on the show.
Everybody had been chasing Peter Brozowitz, trying to talk with Peter Brozowitz, because early on, again, he was one of the main suspects. And then all of a sudden, he shows up on this Dr. Phil special.
Peter had been cleared by police, but in the eyes of Brittany's parents and here on the Dr. Phil show, he seemed to be guilty of something.
If you're a gentleman, why wouldn't you walk my daughter to her hotel or drive her there, knowing it was dark out that night?
And maybe his answers were a little tone deaf.
I'm on spring break. I'm not there to babysit anybody.
So maybe just guilty of insensitivity, a distraction in the end from the goal of finding Brittany. And there were other distractions. One of them was heartbreaking.
Didn't you get a call from Brittany's phone at one point?
That was a tough one. I never expected to get a phone call. And it just happened one night. I'm like, what?
It was October, 6 months after Brittany disappeared. Chad was at home with friends, watching a game on TV. And for a moment, Chad thought his daughter was reaching out to him.
And the phone rings and you look at the number.
Everyone's like, hurry up and answer it.
It wasn't Brittany, of course. Her phone number had been reassigned to a man who couldn't understand why he kept getting calls from one particular number, and that, of course, was Chad, who had been calling Brittany over and over, just in case.
Wow.
Yeah.
You get shivers just thinking about that, actually.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, reporter Graham Moore got word that police were closing in on some likely suspects.
Behind the scenes, we were hearing from detectives and other sources that they were looking pretty hard at a group of guys very near the location where Brittany's cell phone last pinged.
So there were leads, but no arrests. A year went by. In April 2010, Brittany's family and friends gathered in Myrtle Beach. Her little brother, Camden, was there.
We're doing a march.
You're going to march? For who?
My sister.
Who are we marching for?
Can you say
my
Brittany?
On the shirt.
Who's that on the shirt?
I'm Brett.
So you don't remember anything about that trip in 2010?
I slightly do. I do remember we had a big banner walking down the boulevard, and I was with close family and some friends that were doing the march. A walk down the boulevard with it. Then I remember a candlelit vigil we had for Britt.
What a strange way to grow up, right? Where you really don't know the answer to one of the most important questions in your life.
Yeah, questioning every once in a while, where's Sissy? Where's Sissy? Where's Britt? It was hard. It was hard.
It was during that trip Brittany's father, Chad, retraced her steps along South Ocean Boulevard and looked out at the crowd.
You could already sense the craziness out with the cars and the guys, and you can see them looking at the girls and stuff. It's just, if they're not traveling in groups, it just seems like it's like a meat fest.
Is it upsetting to see it?
Well, yeah. It's like I want to go on the news just to tell, you know, these spring breakers that travel in groups.
Kids hear that all their lives, of course. Don't like talk to strangers. Chad seemed confident that Brittany would have abided by that basic rule.
See, I don't think Brittany would have went up to any stranger in the car like that.
So back to the question, who did Brittany go with that night? Was it someone she knew? Those questions took on new meaning when police got evidence that Brittany did indeed trust at least one stranger during her visit to Myrtle Beach.
Hey, Brett.
Coming up, a woman with a frightening friend.
Oh, we all have these fantasies about snatching girls off the street and raping them.
Was there a connection to Brittany?
Talked about, you know, he's done bad stuff in the past.
As sure as the season, spring break marks the passage of time in Myrtle Beach. In the spring of 2010, the party crowd gathered again. And that is when Myrtle Beach police released another video.
A young man contacted us saying that he thought he might have a video of Brittany from the time that he was down here for spring break.
This is Brittany.
Hey, Brett.
What?
The night before, she disappeared. Police talked to the young spring breaker who shot it.
She had been walking down and being harassed because she's a young, attractive girl, and she asked if he'd walk with her and ultimately went to, I guess, his motel room, and they talked for a while.
And just hung out with him and some of his friends.
Was that the end of the story? Or was this a new person of interest?
No, never. No, he contacted us saying, hey, I just saw a special on Brittany being missing, and I just let you know that I was there in Myrtle Beach and met her. Never considered him a suspect.
So apparently she put her trust in the right person that time. But what about the next night, the night she disappeared? Did she trust another stranger? Someone like him? He is Raymond Moody, a sex offender who had done time in a California prison for rape.
He would come in here and cry.
Now he was back home in South Carolina, where he had to report to Wendy Powers of the Georgetown County Sheriff's Office.
Very remorseful. Talked about, he's done bad stuff in the past. And he called himself a monster in here before.
But he'd settled down, seemed to have changed.
He was the nicest guy you could talk to. Well-mannered. Always on time.
Even so, he was a convicted predator. So, about a year and a half after Brittany disappeared, Deputy Powers looked up Moody's location the day she vanished, just in case. And what do you know? He'd been staying only a few miles from where her phone last pinged.
So that's how Raymond come in the spotlight to me. Someone needed to know about this guy.
She took the file to Captain Ken McKenzie of SLED, the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, and Phil Hanna, a criminal investigator with the Sheriff's Office. They were taking a whole new look at Brittany's case and would soon be joined by Mike Hull of the Myrtle Beach Police Department, and together, they found that old Moody report deeply interesting.
And that was eye-opening.
I imagine so.
For us. Because one particular part of that was that he admitted that he would not stop.
It was all in the file. Moody left California after a long incarceration and then returned to Georgetown, his hometown, with a boyfriend he'd met in prison. And then pretty soon he had a girlfriend, too. Her name is Angel Voss. So, a love triangle of sorts. And one night, according to a tipster, Angel called the boyfriend, looking for Ray. And maybe gave away something?
She called him drunk one night and said that she can't live with what she knows that he did.
The cops heard about that and just had to know, what did Ray do? They asked Angel to come in. She happily talked about Ray.
He's not a drinker. He don't do any kind of drugs. He don't smoke cigarettes. He don't do any of that.
She also talked about his creepier impulses.
Oh, he always has these fantasies about snatching girls off the street and raping them and then taking them somewhere and dumping them.
Well, surely that must have been what happened to Brittany.
One thing in particular is this. Brittany Drexel. She went missing April 25th, 2009.
Okay. I'll be honest, I can't tell you where I was 2 weeks ago or really where he was. Like I said, you got to wake up. Sometimes he's not there.
There was a lot she couldn't remember.
So if I tell you that you made the comment that Raymond had told you something about being responsible for the disappearance of that young girl.
Would I remember saying it? No, to be honest with you, I wouldn't remember saying it. Has he ever said her name? Yes. Yeah.
So it went. Maybe he attacked that girl or other women, or maybe not. But if he did...
He was like going to be short. Somebody he can snatch up that wouldn't be able to fight him.
Do you know if he has any place he can go to like that?
Not really, but he has said that he has a tent.
Mm-hmm.
And that he could just set up a tent some remote area. But, I haven't seen the tent.
They left Angel alone for a few minutes.
God forgive me for being with this crazy man.
Did she know they were still watching this, recording it?
What if he's doing it again? God, please let him get caught.
Was this for real? No way to know. And she hadn't given them a reason to arrest Ray, but maybe his movements would tell them something. They got a warrant for a tracking device.
And we managed to get it and put the device on the vehicle to track him for several weeks.
They tracked him to work sites mostly. Ray had become a woodworker. But he also stopped by a local cemetery. Did that mean something? The investigators also got a search warrant for this place, the Sunset Lodge in Georgetown. That's where Moody was briefly residing at the time of Brittany's disappearance.
They looked for any kind of biological evidence, hair, fiber.
Serological.
Anything.
Kind of turned it inside out.
Yes.
DNA.
Unfortunately, nothing was found that could help us.
But when local reporters found out about it,
investigators set up for hours today.
The story made its way across the country to a woman named Carrie Harding out in Vallejo, California. And she picked up the phone.
I called and left a message that said I was the first victim of Raymond Moody.
Coming up.
Just as I passed, he snatched me from behind and put me in the car.
Is that what happened to Brittany?
He said, I don't have nothing to say to y'all. He said, you're good detectives, you figure it out.
When Dateline continues.
It was a voicemail that alerted the investigators in South Carolina. A woman from California with something important to say about Ray Moody.
And they called me back in seconds, like 30 seconds.
Her name is Carrie Harding.
I actually called and talked to her, and she was really anxious to help.
And I said, I want to help put him back away.
And to hear her story is to understand why.
I have nightmares often, terrible nightmares.
About the thing itself?
Yeah. Just where I'm running and trying to get away.
Carrie still lives in Vallejo, California, and not far from where she first encountered Raymond Moody, who was living there in 1983.
How old were you?
I was 8.
Do you remember what you were doing that day?
It was a Sunday afternoon, early afternoon, and I was walking to the school to meet a girlfriend to play.
And she saw a young man, early 20s, standing by his car.
And he unlocked the passenger door to his car. Just as I passed, he snatched me from behind and put me in the car.
Do you remember what that was like?
It's just fear. The fear is overwhelming. It immobilizes you. Where you can't really scream or you just freeze.
He drove a few miles away to an undeveloped housing tract where he raped and sodomized her.
There's no right word to describe it. It's just complete terror.
Yeah, no big enough words. And pain, I would think.
Oh, yeah, I was, yeah.
What did you think was going to happen to you?
I thought I was going to die.
Stuck there in the back.
I thought I was going to die, for sure. Eventually, I just was really insistent that I had to go to the bathroom. I just kept telling him, I have to go to the bathroom. And finally, he opened the back door to the car, and he was like, squat down right here. And he had me by, had a hold of the top of my hair. He was holding my hair, and when I squatted down, there was blood that came. And when he saw that, he kind of was like, and he let go of my hair.
And then that 8-year-old girl did something amazing. She saved herself.
I took off running. There were people in the distance, and I just remember running towards them, screaming, I was kidnapped, you know.
How'd you have the presence of mind to do that?
I don't know.
The strangers gathered up the bloodied, terrified little girl and called the police and Carrie's mother.
While I was in the hospital, I was still saying, nothing happened, Mom, nothing happened. And she's like, you're bleeding. You know, what do you mean, nothing happened? Finally, I just started telling little bits more.
She couldn't remember anything to identify the man. Until one day,
it dawned on me that there was a green sticker on the back of his car.
It was a bumper sticker. Required for the entrance to Mare Island, the nearby naval base. That narrowed the list of suspects for sure. A few days later, Carrie was asked to come to the police station.
And they had handed me like a stack of folders with mugshots, and I'm going through them, and I'm looking and looking, and the last picture in the last folder was him. And I wasn't going to say it.
You weren't going to say it?
My mom, yeah, the fear again just comes over you. And she said, which one is it? She knew. And I pointed, and the police said, we got him. We got him. We got him right now. He's in the back.
Raymond Moody, who was stationed at that naval base, was already under arrest for multiple sexual assaults on young women and little girls. He pleaded guilty to charges that included rape and sodomy and kidnapping and was sentenced to 40 years in prison. He served just over 20, and that's when he moved home to South Carolina, where the cops working the Drexel case were now hearing Carrie Harding's story.
She was saying, yeah, he did it. I mean, he did it. Of course, that was up to us to prove.
Oh, yeah.
But finding proof can be a tricky thing.
He came in to report again one day for registry. And Mike and I asked him, we'd like to talk to him and give him a chance, you know, to clear his name, give us an alibi. And he said, I don't have nothing to say to y'all. He said, you're good detectives, you figure it out.
And though they kept it up for another year, every new piece of what looked like evidence was just a little too patchy.
We used to say all the time, like the devil himself is helping them, because every time we would start to run something down, it'd be like, yeah, it looks good, but that ain't enough.
Raymond Moody really was the perfect suspect, the boogeyman, the obvious choice. But then the FBI swooped in with a whole different answer to the mystery surrounding Brittany Drexel. The obvious choice isn't always the right one.
Coming up.
Obviously, they found something that we didn't have.
A new suspect and a grim story.
I'm being told that, yes, this is what happened to your daughter.
They felt they'd exhausted all the leads that time and technology allowed. By 2015, the task force members had retired or been reassigned.
And we still talked. I mean, if something come up, we still talked. But we had run it until we couldn't see anywhere else to go with at that time.
Once again, the search for Brittany Drexel was going nowhere, except quietly. Another agency was poking around, and then, not so quietly. In 2016, the FBI made a blockbuster announcement. It happened here, in the little town of McClellanville, not far from Pole Yard Landing.
Brittany Drexel did leave the Myrtle Beach area. We believe she traveled to this area around McClellanville and the North Charleston, South Georgetown area. And we believe she was killed after that.
This was the first time anyone had said definitively that Brittany was dead.
It was a very big deal.
Brett Davidson covered the news conference for NBC's Rochester affiliate, WHEC.
They had various law enforcement that was there. They had family there.
We know there's people that saw something, heard something.
And they were making a plea to the community, specifically in McClellanville, to help them. Because what they still didn't have was a body. And what they still didn't have, or at least they weren't talking about, was a suspect.
They clearly had a theory about who did it, and it wasn't Ray Moody.
Did you see that press conference?
Yeah, I saw it.
We all saw it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When that came out, I said that. They found something that we didn't have.
So what did the FBI have? The day before that news conference, investigators brought Brittany's family in to tell them something they weren't going to tell the public.
I'm being flown down to the area, told that, yes, this is what happened to your daughter.
The details were horrible, heartbreaking. They came from a jailhouse informant who told the FBI he had seen Brittany at this stash house in McClellanville a few days after she disappeared. He said she was being sexually assaulted by a group of men, and when she tried to run away, the informant said, they shot her, killed her, took her body away, Other witnesses told the FBI they heard Brittany's body was thrown into an alligator pit.
There's all those emotions that someone killed her and then threw her in the pit. I just thought that we might never know, you know.
The very idea of it, my God, it must just wear at you.
Yeah.
Brittany's little brother was almost 13.
I don't remember who said it, but they told us what happened to my sister, and I ran into the laundry room, started crying and breaking down, and then I went right outside, and I just was very devastated.
Not the sort of thing you forget?
No, not at all.
What's that like, sort of the bottom falling out of your world or something?
Yeah, the little part of my heart kind of cracked, I'd say. And it just really put me into a dark place at that time, at that moment.
The family wasn't told the name of the alleged killer or killers. But later that summer, the FBI moved in on one of their suspects, a guy named Timothy Taylor. But they didn't charge him with killing Brittany. No, they brought him into federal court on new charges related to an armed robbery from years earlier. Now, agents told a federal judge they were investigating Taylor's possible connection to the Brittany Drexel case.
His attorney himself said that they were trying to squeeze him, that they were trying to use these new charges against him to try and get him to provide information.
Information, evidence, about what he and the other men had supposedly done to Brittany. The shooter was probably Tim Taylor's father, according to the informant.
He had gone to the stash house to speak with Tim Taylor's father over some financial debt. And that during the course of that, Brittany tried to get out, run out, that she was pistol whipped, brought back in. And then he said shortly after that he heard a couple of gunshots and that he saw individuals bring out a rolled up rug, put it in the back of a truck and drive off.
Now they wanted Taylor to talk about all of it. The federal judge let Taylor out on bail. And that's when he encountered a media storm.
An eyewitness who is in prison came forward.
Timothy Taylor was involved in Drexel's disappearance.
Accusing Timothy Deshaun Taylor of being involved in the Brittany Drexel case.
You must have felt pretty, had some dark thoughts about Tim Taylor.
Oh yeah. So now it's like, okay, well what, who else was involved?
Brett Davidson decided to ask Taylor and his then attorney for an interview.
I was surprised they said yes.
I may as well start with the obvious question. Did you kill Brittany Drexel?
No, sir. I did not kill Brittany Drexel.
Well, of course he'd say that. But what else would Timothy Taylor have to say?
Coming up, Timothy Taylor talks, and that jailhouse informant has a new story.
To say I was surprised would be an understatement. That was the first time I'd heard that.
When Dateline continues.
The FBI had linked a name to the crimes against Brittany Drexel. Timothy Taylor. And those crimes were too terrible to contemplate. Federal agents had witnesses, including a jailhouse snitch, who claimed Brittany was raped and shot at the stash house, her body thrown into an alligator pit. Chad Drexel said he asked investigators, "Are you sure?"
What evidence do you have? We can't tell you exactly, but we can tell you all the evidence that we have leads to this. And we are almost positive.
You have agents testifying under oath that they have witnesses, that they've spoken to people who say this happened.
WHEC Rochester reporter Brett Davidson got a chance to ask Taylor directly.
I may as well start with the obvious question. Did you kill Brittany Drexel?
No, sir. I did not kill Brittany Drexel.
Were you involved in the kidnapping of Brittany Drexel?
No, sir, I was not.
Timothy Taylor was, by then, 25 years old. He'd lost an arm in a childhood accident.
Well, first of all, he was courteous. He was soft-spoken. physically slight. Of course, he has the disability with missing the one arm. So, you know, looking at him physically, I had questions about whether I thought he himself could have even abducted or been involved in the abduction of Brittany Drexel. Are you aware at all of your father having any involvement in this Brittany Drexel case?
No, sir.
Taylor said he'd never met the snitch who fingered him and his father, never even heard of the guy.
I honestly don't have anything or have any information to help them because I honestly don't know anything.
It seems like you've been kind of painted in a corner now.
Yes, sir.
What are you going to do?
Pretty much I just stay to myself, pray and hope that when it's all over and done, everybody going to apologize and they realize that I really didn't have anything to do with it or even know anything about it.
Once the reality of it sank in, I think he quickly was filled with terror.
Attorney Chris Adams represented Tim Taylor for years.
Like, how can an innocent man be linked or suspected to be involved in a crime they had no involvement with?
In this case, the answer lies in an old crime that Tim Taylor did commit a few years earlier.
So he was a participant in an armed robbery. He was the getaway driver. He was arrested a few days later. He told the police that he did it. The full case was laid out, and he received a youthful offender sentence, suspended on 2 years probation.
Then, years later, that snitch started talking, and the FBI arrested Taylor on federal charges for that same old crime. Illegal but unusual tactic, said Chris Adams. As a result, Taylor spent about a year in jail with the threat of more.
They did that as a way to apply pressure on Tim Taylor, to get Tim Taylor to confess to the Drexel homicide and to get him to cooperate against his father, who was the other suspect at the time.
But Taylor never confessed or turned on his father, and so all they had was the informant's story. Solicitor Jimmy Richardson is the lead prosecutor for Horry County, where Myrtle Beach is located.
And we very adamantly said, we're not relying on a jailhouse informant. We're just not going to do that.
Right?
Yeah, we told them, we can't do this with what you've got.
And that's where the case against Timothy Taylor sat for quite some time. A year went by, two, three, no arrest. And then, in 2019, Brett Davidson scored another important interview.
Why don't you tell me what you witnessed?
The prison informant himself, the snitch, Daquan Brown. Brown was just starting a 25-year sentence for voluntary manslaughter.
On this Monday, April 27th, I saw the girl.
In the stash house?
Yeah, okay. It was about 8, 12 guys in there.
That was pretty much what he told the FBI. But over a series of phone calls, Brown's story changed dramatically.
Tristan wasn't killed by the stash house. She was killed in another town called Jackson Farm.
Now, he claimed, he saw Brittany alive days later at this trailer in the town of Jacksonboro, more than 100 miles from Myrtle Beach. And in this new story, he said some guy named Nate shot Brittany, not a Taylor at all.
Nate shot her with a double-barrel shotgun.
And they didn't throw Brittany's body in an alligator pit. No, just buried her in the backyard.
To say I was surprised would be an understatement. That was the first time I'd heard that.
Seemed like the prison informant's story, the FBI's evidence against the Taylors, was squishier than a South Carolina swamp. But the FBI never made that public.
They've never said, hey, we got it wrong. The Taylors are innocent.
Years came and went. The Taylors under suspicion. Brittany's family in grief-bound limbo. And then in 2020, a new team, led again by the FBI, launched a fresh look at Brittany's case. No press conference, no public statements. This time, the FBI seemed determined to get it right.
Coming up, an unexpected suspect.
She even claims that she was the one that killed Brittany Drexel.
And is this the kidnapper's car caught on camera?
She would have been almost 30 in 2021. Brittany's little brother was off to college. Her old friend Tara had finished law school and was studying for the bar.
Over 13 years, I've thought about her and her last moments, what could have happened, what did happen.
Tara had no way of knowing. The investigation had once again hit reset. Prosecutor Jimmy Richardson.
FBI guys came in and just really went back to work, back to square one, and started going through everything. And I think that may have been a result of, you know, sort of getting mud in your face.
Digging through the case file, they found something interesting related to Angel Voss. Remember her, Raymond Moody's girlfriend?
Oh, we always had these fantasies about snatching girls off the street.
3 years after that interview, back in 2014, police secretly recorded a conversation Angel was having with a friend. Angel was complaining about all the suspicion directed at Ray.
She was mad and she was trying to defend him.
The audio has never been released publicly, but senior investigator Hank Carrison of the Georgetown County Sheriff's Office has heard it. He joined the FBI investigation.
But when pressed on the issue, Angel does start to reiterate that she has been involved in it. At one point in time, she even claims that she was the one that killed Brittany Drexel.
Angel? Angel Voss was the killer? So why didn't they arrest her back then? Well, according to Carrison, she appeared to be drunk and she got things wrong. It had to be a lie.
I can't surmise why other law enforcement agencies did or didn't do things, but I wouldn't have considered that actionable intelligence.
No.
It certainly arouses suspicion.
But then, a break. A big one. It was this surveillance video. Look at that car. It's heading directly toward Brittany, just as she is texting her boyfriend for what will be the last time. It's a Ford Explorer. It hadn't seemed important before, but now improved technology sharpened the image of the car enough that they could trace it. And the Explorer was registered to Angel Voss's brother. Of course, the FBI was beyond eager to talk to Angel. And as luck would have it, Hank Carrison knew her from a completely different investigation.
Asked her to come down to the sheriff's office, say we were going to talk about something completely unrelated.
In other words, something that wouldn't scare her off.
Absolutely.
Going back to 2009.
It was now 2022. Angel was a nurse. She arrived in her hospital scrubs. And that's when she learned this talk was really about Brittany Drexel.
Angel said, these men are here from the FBI. They'd like to ask you a couple questions.
At first, Angel seemed oddly cheerful as she talked about her life, her dating history with Ray Moody, her family.
That's a good thing.
They went on for a couple of hours, Angel chatting, laughing, forgetting, especially about that car she was driving.
How about any cars you had back then? That you can remember?
Give me a minute.
No.
And then the agent suggested Angel herself was under suspicion.
Did you have any involvement in picking up Brittany Drexel?
Hell no. Mostly did not.
They mentioned that old secret recording. Wanted to read some quotes from it.
I tell you what. Don't leave me there.
She seemed to think they'd recorded something Ray said, and she jumped to defend him.
Because if you're trying to accuse him of anything, then I'm not going to be involved in it. Because I say he didn't, okay? I say he did not.
I'm not accusing him.
Yeah, you are. I'm straightforward,
hey,
too. Can we just talk? No, I'm straightforward, too. I don't think he did. And you're not going to involve him in it.
She takes off. She comes right back downstairs. I intercept her and I talk to her.
And he made something clear.
They're not here to talk about Ray. They're here to talk about you. Now, if you got something you want to go in there and clear up, now's the time.
Minutes later, she returned.
I'm back.
Okay. Now she understood about that old recording, the one in which she said she killed Brittany. and she had an explanation. She was lying back then, she said, to protect Ray.
I was just wanting everybody to leave him alone. So I put the blame on me instead of him.
Is that true, though?
No. No, I would never hurt anybody.
Angel's memory continued to fail her. But then she made a suggestion. Maybe the phone she was carrying in 2009 could jog her memory.
Wait, you know what? I probably still have that phone.
You still have that phone? Okay.
A cell phone from 2009?
Mm-hmm.
Did you immediately perk up when you heard that?
Absolutely.
The phone could be hard evidence about where she was the night Brittany disappeared. So they got a search warrant and sent an army of investigators out to Ray and Angel's house.
How many people did you have over there?
Oh, God. 20, 25 probably.
That's making sure.
Yeah, it was a hootenanny out there.
As the FBI headed out to join the search, they heard Ray and Angel had left the house. Minutes later, agents met up with them in a church parking lot.
Yeah, Ray gets out, approaches the vehicle. I can imagine that was kind of tense. You don't know what this guy's going to do.
And Ray says something of the equivalent, I've got a big surprise for you now. The FBI agent thought he was talking about, I'm going to kill myself and take this information to the grave. And he says, Ray, you've got it all wrong. We're not after you. We're after Angel.
That, apparently, got his attention. Suddenly, after 13 years, Ray Moody was up against a wall. But as it turned out, he really did have a big surprise for them.
Coming up, Ray Moody tells us his version of what happened the night Brittany disappeared.
My crazy self just kind of stepped in and said, hey, you know, here's this opportunity.
When Dateline continues.
The search out at Ray Moody's place didn't turn up anything useful, not even Angel's old phone. But did it have the desired effect on Ray? It certainly did, especially when they told him the target of the investigation was not him but Angel. Angel who knew all his secrets. And then, suddenly, Ray Moody announced he was ready to talk. And in May 2022, in custody now, and surrounded by cops and attorneys, he offered a confession. And then he told his story to us. Illness had aged him, cost him an eye, but as was soon clear, not the desire to manipulate as he presented the version of Ray Moody he wanted me to believe was real. That is, a good man who a few times years ago briefly became a monster.
I felt like I was just like two different people. Just two different people.
Then, an excuse, which he offered a little sooner than I'd expected. The excuse that his jailers in California had failed to rehabilitate him. So, their fault?
I was actually frustrated because during my entire incarceration, they never made one little effort to provide any kind of help for me.
I sat back, listened, let him talk, and cry, because he'd been separated from the little girl he loved, Angel's granddaughter, a girl the same age Carrie Harding was when he attacked her.
How old is she?
She's eight. And,
same age as that girl out in California.
Yeah.
Hard to imagine something like that happening to your granddaughter.
I can't.
I'd been told he was clever, could seem genuine. And yet here, weeping, he almost reeked of calculation. And tears gone as fast as they came, he changed tactics and launched into the tale that he claimed was an honest confession of true events. The night he spied pretty petite Brittany walking along South Ocean Boulevard.
And I was in the car, and I called her, and she came over to the window. And she smiled, she looked in, she looked around, and asked her if she wanted to party with us a little bit. We were smoking some pot. just having a good time like everybody else.
Now there was a tell. I'd just heard from multiple people. Brittany hated pot.
And I could see her mind working. And she said, yeah, and she got in. I've always thought, God, why should she get in, you know? Don't ever get in a vehicle with a stranger.
But Angel was with you.
Yeah.
Two middle-aged people in a car.
Yeah.
You looked safe.
Yeah, I guess that's what she thought.
On he forged with his awful tale, told as if describing a pleasant drive to the beach.
Small conversation.
She had to be getting pretty frightened at that
point. She really wasn't. She really wasn't.
That's, but that's...
I know, it's hard to imagine.
Well, it certainly is, isn't it? And why did her text suddenly stop? Just happened that way, he said.
But you're telling me that during that entire time, this constant texter, constantly texting...
Yeah, that's boyfriend. What young people do.
Just stopped. As soon as she get in your car, she stopped texting anybody from then until the moment she died.
Yep.
A lie, of course. The hour before she vanished, she sent out 17 texts, 100 that day. Would she have responded to this from her boyfriend? Please call me. Please. Of course she would have. But she didn't. Couldn't. Why take her to Pole Yard Landing? Remember that tent Angel told the cops she had never actually seen? Ray's tent? Well, it was right here. She knew all along. She had been there.
Got out of the vehicle and walked up to our camp area.
Uh-huh.
And then we're just talking a little bit, smoking a little bit of pot. And Angel decided that it was about time to meet up with her son. She took off. She's gone for a good while, too.
So she left you alone with a 17-year-old girl?
Yeah, yep. But once she was gone, my crazy self just kind of stepped in and said, hey, you know, here's this opportunity. I didn't plan that out like that. That's just the way it went down.
And then he raped her.
Isn't that what you planned to do all along?
No.
Innocent as the driven snow until that very moment, huh?
Pretty close to it, yeah.
Brittany struggled, he said, at first, but then...
So I guess she figured the best thing for her to do is just cooperate. Yeah.
She was terrified.
I'm sure she was. Yep. You'd be surprised sometimes. It's not like the movies. It's not like the movies.
What do you mean?
The way people react in situations. Sometimes they're very calm. Yeah. Like, with my experiences, 99% of the time. Yeah.
These young women realized they were about to be sexually assaulted, and so
they're cooperative.
Because they were scared of you.
Correct.
Because they were afraid you might do to them exactly what you did to Brittany.
Exactly, probably, yeah.
Then you strangled her.
Yes, sir.
You could have let her go.
I could have. But I didn't for selfish reasons. Because I didn't want her to go into the police. And then I'd be going back to prison the rest of my life.
After, he carried Brittany's body into the woods. And when Angel returned, he told her Brittany had left with friends. A story he claimed Angel accepted.
Yeah. She didn't question me.
So that was his story. The very same one he told the police. But sitting here with him, I could not stop thinking about that 17-year-old girl. How frightened she must have been. Abducted and helpless. As they drove out of town to that tent in the woods. As he held her down and raped her. And strangled her life away. And now had just besmirched her character.
You put yourself here, I got to tell you, pretty skillfully. In the sense that
If I were going to confess to raping and murdering a young woman,
yeah,
I would want to make her somehow complicit in the event. In other words, I didn't go out there and see a woman coming along the side of the street and that old impulse takes over and I think I got to get that one. Rather, I would say, she wanted to come along. She wanted to party. Well, things got out of control.
Great, yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Bull. That's not how it happened.
No, you don't think so?
These investigators, who'd worked the case years before, agreed.
Don't believe him. No. That didn't happen.
No. I personally think this couple pulled up, offered her a ride, and she took it because she was in a hurry. And she took it because I believe Angel's right there, so she's thinking, okay, it's not just this creepy dude. There's a woman there, too. I'll be okay. We're on the boulevard. They'll take me up there real quick. I'll jump out. That's what I think happened.
But to the law, Ray Moody's story was a confession to rape and murder, though it left some unanswered questions. For one thing, where was Brittany Drexel?
Coming up.
And I said, the biggest thing is you got to take us to the body. And he said, I can do that.
And will we ever know Angel's role?
Seems pretty clear that his confession is very carefully tailor-made to protect Angel.
That's why we have to continue to investigate.
There's a lot of stuff. I remember like yesterday.
Who could have guessed it would end this way? Brittany Drexel's killer just gave it all up. But was that really all? There'd been so many false leads. How could the prosecutor know this was real?
And I said, the biggest thing is you got to take us to the body. And he said, I can do that.
Moody moved Brittany's body the night he killed her, about 10 miles away. So that's where he took investigators. And there, buried on the property of unsuspecting homeowners, they found her. Remember that cemetery to which investigators had tracked Ray's car? That was just a short walk to Brittany's grave. And just like that, after 13 years and an ocean of heartache, it was over. It was May 2022. Her family came to see the place she'd been all those years.
You know, I'm just thinking all these just insanely bad thoughts, but thinking, they start praying. And the weirdest thing is, the owner of the land, the wife, came right up to me and said, can I ask you a question? Would you mind if I planted a tree here for your daughter? And I lost. I said, absolutely.
Good afternoon. Thank you for being here today. The Georgetown County Sheriff's Office charges against Mr. Raymond Moody are murder, kidnapping, criminal sexual conduct in the first degree.
And just at the end, someone called out this question.
What does this mean for Timothy Taylor?
Timothy Taylor had spent years under a cloud of ugly suspicion, fingered by an informant who lied. I asked Reed Davis about that. Davis is Assistant Special Agent in Charge for the FBI in Columbia, South Carolina.
How long before you realized that jailhouse informant was not correct, was all wet?
I would say sometime around 2018. Was when he actually recanted on his statements. So we definitely kind of shut down that line of effort at that point.
But no one ever said publicly that the evidence against Taylor had fallen apart.
Created enormous amounts of damage in the Taylor's life, especially Timothy Taylor, who, you know, I mean, they were losing jobs, they were losing friends. Was there anything the FBI could have done to correct that when it happened?
Well, I don't know specifically what the FBI could have done to correct it.
Well,
only because
they said, okay, he's not a suspect anymore. At some point along the way, like 18 or 19, couldn't you have done that?
Well, I could see why you'd ask that for sure. But when we hadn't completed the investigation yet, it's very difficult to say with absolute positivity that someone isn't involved.
The Taylor family was in court when Ray Moody was sentenced.
They're upset still, and they're looking for an apology from your agency. Do you think that they might get one?
I don't know if we would be the appropriate party to apologize, simply for the fact that we were doing everything possible to recover Brittany Drexel.
And while we know Timothy Taylor was not involved, the same cannot be said for someone else.
There were, after all, three people in the car. There was, Brittany and Ray and Angel. Yeah, I'm sure you've talked to two of the three.
Absolutely.
Seems pretty clear that his confession is very carefully tailor-made to protect Angel, to make sure that she doesn't get charged as being an accessory to this crime, or worse.
The statement conveniently leaves her out of any commission of a crime, absolutely. So that's why we have to continue to investigate.
So I could see where there'd be a little more work to be done.
Absolutely, and Ms. Drexel deserves it.
Kerry Harding, Moody's victim from so many years ago, believes he has other victims law enforcement still does not know about.
If I could just say one thing to him, that's what it would be. Just tell the truth on how many. And you know what I mean? If you're going to come clean and tell the truth about Brittany Drexel, tell the truth on all of it.
Brittany's family was there when Moody was sentenced to life without parole. He will die in prison. This is Brittany's mother, Dawn.
Brittany wanted to get married. She loved kids and wanted to be a mom, a career woman, a wife. But you took that all away from her.
Chad struggled to describe the depth of his loss.
I'll never be able to walk Brittany down the aisle. Neither will her blood father or Dawn. She'll never be able to see my granddaughter, her niece, who's here, is amazing. All that's snatched away from us.
He talks a lot about the importance of family and fatherhood.
You need to be in their lives. You need to be, I always say, in their business as much as you can.
For Tara, memories of Brittany are as clear as a snapshot. Like that day on Lake Ontario.
Some of my favorite memories with Brittany is just going to Charlotte Beach, and we were wearing the same shirt, different colors. We were both wearing bright blue eyeshadow, and we were just writing in the sand, and we were taking all these photos of just us in the sand.
They were so young, and imagine they were invulnerable, especially when they weren't.
That's all for now. I'm Lester Holt. Thanks for joining us.